Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Today's reading, I'd like to use Ajahn Jeff's book on the on right mindfulness, and we'll see. I mean, I don't want to read the whole thing, but certainly the first chapter. And I'll have to look at it a bit further to see what else. But certainly the first chapter is a great... Because what I wanted to do, we've been given... we began the teachings and readings, and we've been giving some very specific... techniques and details of the mindfulness of the body, and I'd like to just sort of step back again and come back, because we started with giving sort of overview, or I started giving overview, and then we've gone into specific kind of techniques and methods of practice, and I'd like to kind of pull back again and take a an overview and come from that perspective. So, because I think it's important to recognize that this developing of the four foundations of mindfulness has that quality of being able to hone in on specifics, but then also it has a very broad application, and it's important to understand that, because it's easy, just the way the human mind works, is we like to see things in black and white, and it's sort of it's either this or it's that. It has to be. It can't be both or some iteration between the two. So that in coming back and looking at an overview. And it begins with a quote from Anguttara 7, Sutta number 63 is what Ajahn Jeff has, and in the Anguttara Nikaya of that recent publication of Bhikkhu Bodhi's, it is actually listed as Anguttara 7:67. So I don't know what the discrepancy is, but it's what it is. Just as a royal frontier fortress has a gatekeeper, wise, experienced, intelligent, to keep out those he doesn't know, and to let in those he does, for the protection of those within and to ward off those without. In the same way, a disciple of the noble ones is mindful, endowed with excellent proficiency in mindfulness, remembering and recollecting what was done and said a long time ago. With mindfulness as its gatekeeper, the disciple of the noble ones abandons what is unskillful, develops what is skillful, abandons what is blameworthy, develops what is blameless, and looks after himself with purity. So that's a great overview already. So this is chapter one, Mindfulness, the Gatekeeper. The Buddha adopted the term sati from the languages of his culture is related to the Sanskrit term smriti, which means remembrance or the act of calling to mind. However, there is no record of his having defined the term per se. Instead, the texts depict him as observing that there are two types of sati when viewed from the perspective of a person trying to put an end to suffering, right and wrong. That is, right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness. The texts also show him defining the faculty of sati, satindriya, which is equivalent to right sati. And this is from Samyutta Nikaya 48, sutta number 10. And what is the faculty of sati? There is the case where a disciple of the noble ones has sati, is endowed with excellent proficiency in sati, remembering and recollecting what was done and said a long time ago. He remains focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and having sati, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. He remains focused on feelings in and of themselves, the mind in and of itself, mental qualities in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and having sati, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. This is called the faculty of sati. This definition of right sati falls into two parts. In the first sentence, the Buddha is obviously retaining the meaning of its Sanskrit cognate, remembrance, showing how sati, when developed to the point of being a faculty or dominant factor in the mind, and that's what indriya means, something which is dominant or of a major impulse, or a dominant factor in the mind, is able to remember words and actions far into the past. The second part of the definition is identical with the definition of right sati in the Noble Eightfold Path, and is often called the establishing of sati. Sati plus upatthana. Upatthana means establishing or setting near, and this is where the word satipatthana comes, is a combination of those two words. This part of the definition sets out the task of that sati, of that sati is meant to keep in mind. This part of the definition sets out the task that sati is meant to keep in mind, along with the other mental factors that have to be developed, and the concerns that need to be subdued to help keep sati firmly established on its task. In the practice of the path, sati and satipatthana are mutually reinforcing. On the one hand, as the satipatthana formula states, sati is one of the factors brought to bear on the task of remaining focused as a part of satipatthana. On the other, Samyutta 48.11 notes that the practice of satipatthana gives rise to strengthened sati. And this is a quote from it. And which is the faculty of sati? Whatever sati one obtains from the four establishings of sati, that is the faculty of sati. So just as physical strength grows by being used in exercise, sati is strengthened by being applied to the task of the four establishings of sati. This has practical consequences that we will discuss further below. The central task of satipatthana is to remain focused on any one of the four topics as a frame of reference. The phrase, remaining focused on, is nowhere defined in the canon, but the Pali term, anupassana, which is a, say, anu means to follow, and passana is seeing. It's not passano, it's passana. This is, you see all the misspellings of my name, is the So this vipassana is seeing, similar to dasana. So anu means to follow, passana, seeing, is commonly used for two types of meditation practice: keeping watch over a particular topic in the midst of other experiences, and looking for a particular quality in experiences as they arise. Both types of anupassana are relevant in the practice of establishing sati. An example of the first comes in the standard Satipatthana formula: remaining focused on the body in and of itself, for example, means keeping track of the body or a particular aspect of the body as a frame of reference in the midst of all your sensory experiences. Even when another topic looms large in your awareness, you try to keep track of where the body is in the midst of that awareness, or of how that other topic and the body interact. In this way, the body remains your frame of reference, regardless of whatever else may arise. The same principle applies when remaining focused on feelings, mind, or mental qualities in and of themselves. As for the second type of anupassana, looking for a particular quality in experiences as they arise, an example would be the practice of looking for inconstancy, anicca, in all phenomena. This, as we will see in Chapter 2, is one of the steps by which sati is established through breath meditation. So that if we're in anicca anupassana, is the last four steps in the Anapanasati Sutta, is the word that says you're contemplating impermanence, one breathes in, contemplating impermanence, one breathes out. The same way, contemplating dispassion, one breathes in. It's viraga anupassana. Contemplating dispassion, one breathes in. Contemplating dispassion, one breathes out. Contemplating cessation, one breathes in. Contemplating cessation, one breathes out. So, nirodha anupassana. And then the last one of contemplating relinquishment, patinissagahanupassana. Those are ways of reflecting on this, or seeing these two different applications of anupassana. Any questions? I don't want to sort of overwhelm people with too much information. There's a lot already. Okay. Yeah.
This is in Venerable Nalu's new book. He covers a lot of the same ground. He sort of points out that present moment awareness and this notion of like remembering things passed on are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
Right.
And like you're totally just spacing out.
Yeah.
You don't know what just happened, so you can't remember it later on.
Right.
So he was really pointing out that like paying clear and close, purposeful attention in the present moment strengthens and enables you to actually remember it.
Yes. It's a really important point, because they, kind of non-differentiated awareness and whatnot is, or whatever the Rupert Gethin. I put the article of Rupert Gethin's into the. I think I got over the monk's room this morning. And he's making a similar point, and quite nicely. Okay, so we'll continue on. The four topics to remain focused on are body, feelings, mind, and mental qualities. Body means the physical body. Feelings covers feeling tones of pleasure, pain, and neither pleasure nor pain. And mind covers states of mind. The phrase mental qualities, dhammas, covers a wider range of phenomena. Its primary meaning in this context covers mental events or mental actions, but it also covers any physical or mental experience viewed as an event. All of these meanings play a role in how right sati makes use of this frame of reference. There is some overlap between the content of mind and mental qualities as frames of reference, but their difference lies primarily in their respective functions. Mind is citta is concerned primarily with how the mind relates to the object of its focus. And that's where, if one goes, say, back to the Satipatthana Sutta, then it's knowing the mind with greed as the mind with greed, knowing the mind without greed as the mind without greed, hatred, knowing the contracted mind as the contracted mind, knowing the expanded mind, so that those are, it's how the mind relates to its object. Mental qualities are concerned with the qualities and thought categories involved in the process of fending off any defilements or distractions that surround that focus or threaten to interfere with it. So then the different categories within the mental qualities or dhammanupassana, there's the five hindrances, the five khandhas, the six sense bases, the seven factors of enlightenment, four noble truths, and like those. So those are categories to be reflecting from. The duty of sati is to remember to remain focused on any one of these topics in and of itself. The Pali passage expresses this idea literally by saying, body in the body, feelings in feelings, etc., with a locative case, a grammatical case indicating location, often translated as in, also meaning with reference to. In other words, each of these topics is viewed solely with reference to itself, on its own terms, without subsuming it under a larger frame of reference, such as the world outside. Each topic is thus a frame of reference in and of itself. And I actually really like Ajahn Jeff's translation of, say, of a Satipatthana as a frame of reference as well as a foundation. The foundation is, say, your alternative translation, foundations of mindfulness, which is good. But then frame of reference, I think, is also very, very helpful. Sometimes these alternative translations are helpful to get a feel for what what it's pointing to.
I think sometimes I've seen Ajahn Jeff use establishings as well.
Yes, that's right.
Analial establishment.
Yeah. Again, that's another one that helps to fill in those. You get a feel for these rather than it just being a like an intellectual concept. We're trying to get us a feel for what these are pointing to and how to use them, how to apply them. Sati is one of three mental factors that should accompany the activity of remaining focused in this way. The other two are alertness and ardency. The canon defines alertness, sampajanya, and again that's often translated as clear comprehension. The canon defines alertness as knowing both events in the mind and activities of the body as they are happening. And this is a quote from Sangyutta 47, Sutta number 35. And how is a monk alert, or one with sampajanya? There is the case where feelings are known to the monk as they arise, known as they become established, known as they subside. Thoughts are known to him as they arise, known as they become established, known as they subside. Perceptions are known to him as they arise, known as they become established, known as they subside. This is how a monk is alert. And then there's another definition or description from Sangyutta 36, Sutta number 7. And how is a monk alert? When going forward and returning, he makes himself alert. When looking toward and looking away, he makes himself alert. When bending and extending his limbs, he makes himself alert. When carrying his outer cloak, his upper robe, and his bowl, he makes himself alert. When eating, drinking, chewing, and savoring, he makes himself alert. When urinating and defecating, he makes himself alert. When walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and remaining silent, he makes himself alert. This is how a monk is alert. This means that for sati to be properly established, it must not only remember far into the past, but also be coupled with a clear awareness of what's going on in the present. Ardency, atapa. What's another translation of ardent? I didn't look at him.
That's the one they use mostly.
Okay. Okay. Ardency, atapa, is the desire to avoid what is unbeneficial. And this is from Sutta, from Samyutta 16, Sutta number 2. And this is actually in the Kassapa Samyutta. And it's a question from, it's in reply to Sariputta asking a question. Sariputta was one, I think, foremost in asking questions. It's never said that, but that is certainly, he's always asking other monks questions. So Venerable Mahakasapa replies, and how is one ardent? There is the case where a monk thinking, unarisen evil, unskillful qualities arising in me would lead to what is unbeneficial. He arouses ardency. Thinking, arisen evil, unskillful qualities not being abandoned in me, he arouses ardency. Unarisen skillful qualities not arising in me, would lead to what is unbeneficial. So he arouses ardency. Arisen skillful qualities ceasing in me would lead to what is unbeneficial. He arouses ardency. That is how one is ardent. The discourses often pair ardency with compunction. Otapa, and that's in that same as Hiri and Otapa. So they're usually put them together. Fear of the consequences of doing evil, perhaps because the words are so similar in meaning and in Pali in sound. And he gives a side note. Here I am using compunction in its American sense as a twinge of scrupulous conscience prior to doing wrong. And that, because compunction is used, because I'm, and this took me by sort of had to go back to my dictionary and see, because that's my own, because I'm more schooled in British meanings, and it depends. We've got a mishmash from in Canada, but that compunction is remorse or regret after an act, and or a scruple, in the sense of. Having no compunction in refusing the person, sort of like compunction as a scruple. Using compunction in its American sense as a scrupulous conscience prior to doing wrong. Working together, these two qualities find expression in the determined abandoning of evil, unskillful qualities. Without them, the goal would be impossible to attain. And he illustrates that by and actually the in the previous sutta, Sariputta also ties it ardency and compunction together as well, but it links the two of them, but it's only drawn out in that as he goes further, so there's a short quote from Ittivuttika Sutta number 34. A person without ardency, without compunction, is incapable of self-awakening, incapable of nibbana, incapable of attaining the unsurpassed safety from bondage. A person ardent and compunctious is capable of self-awakening, capable of nibbana, capable of attaining the unsurpassed safety from bondage. And I thought I would read the whole sutta, which, I mean, it's not very long, but this is the Ittivuttika translated by John Ireland. But it just has a verse to illustrate that a little bit further. And it says, Bhikkhu who is without ardor and without fear of wrongdoing, and so that's the translation of Sampajana, without atapi, ardor, atapi, and without fear of wrongdoing, so anotapa, and that is incapable of attaining enlightenment, incapable of attaining nibbana, incapable of attaining the supreme security from bondage. But a bhikkhu who has ardor and fear of wrongdoing is capable of doing so. And then it finishes with a verse. One who is not ardent, reckless, lazy, and of little vigor, full of lethargy and torpor, shameless and without respect, such a bhikkhu cannot attain enlightenment which is supreme. But a mindful and discerning meditator, ardent, scrupulous, and diligent, having severed the fetters of birth and decay, can attain for himself, right here and now, enlightenment which is supreme. I might leave it there. Any questions?
Lumpur, the mind moves extremely quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm more accustomed to find myself in the middle of thought and see mm-hmm. the end of thought.
Yep.
So anything for advice for the beginning?
You mean mindfulness? You know, a lot of it is it's just that the quote that is put in there of the whatever sati one obtains from the four establishings of sati, that is the faculty of sati. So that it's sort of like it's a positive feedback loop where as one cultivates it, to whatever degree it cultivates it, then it enhances it and builds it up. So you're building a momentum of mindfulness, which then, of course, increases the mindfulness and sharpness of attention. And recognizing that also sometimes we... the arising of thought is is not so much recognized, or, you know, it's seen, but we, because it doesn't, I would say, go out of control and sort of start, you know, wandering or proliferating, then we don't take note of it. We've seen it, but we don't give it attention. So that's another aspect. In the same way that oftentimes we don't notice the ending, because we it's ending, but we don't quite give it the importance that it's needed. Then we so it's that extra attention just to investigate and hold in mind, that one starts to recognize something that one is already doing, but hasn't sort of been able to sort of, like, it's almost like I haven't quite put the finger on the pulse of it, and then as one does that, then you start to notice it a bit more clearly.
I've been investigating something like that, and one thing that I notice is that when I bring the attention back to breath, somehow there's often this hope, expectation, totally unfounded, that the attention is just going to stay right there.
Yeah, good luck.
if that's what I basically kind of my intention, then it's going to be, then I can't see the beginning of thought because I don't want to.
Yeah,
I want the breath, I want the mind to stay.
I just want it to stay fixed, don't change, don't be, just be what I want it.
if you assume that the mind is going to wander, you know, that some thought is going to come up, or even a bit investigating, just, okay, so how much of the mind is actually with the breath right now? Because some of it is going to be somewhere else.
Yeah.
And investigating in that way is easier to see the beginning of thought.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. Because also that sense of recognizing that there's a primary focus and a peripheral focus, and that's happening all the time. So we would like it all to be primary. Yeah.
When I kind of play with that too, it's like there's the bridge or the difference between like a perception and a concept, perceptions and concepts, and with the, you know, there's this kind of perceptual process playing around. It's all kind of really murky, and sometimes words are associated with it. Yeah. But then when the interest takes a hold of it, then it becomes a concept and big thought.
And it's gone. Yeah.
Train of thought. So it's kind of fun to watch that.
How it coalesces,
To earlier part in the reading, there was a great deal of emphasis around recollecting and the ability to remember. And I find with this idea of proliferating thoughts, that when you're trying to do that, you see that sense of causation over time, where I think, oh, I'm thinking that again because I thought of it, you know, because I indulged in it earlier, it'll come back again and again, and it puts more of an impetus on not doing that as a distraction or whatever, because you're only going to bring about that eventuality more in the future too.
So. Right. Yeah, good point.
So sort of part of that too, I mean, I do use a lot of these tools, but I also I try to look, say, like beneath it.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at like the undercurrents, say like the emotional or heart level undercurrents of particularly like restlessness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And bring about that, and you know, instead of trying to put like the thoughts proper in that peripheral,
mm-hmm.
I'm, you know, along with my breath, putting that sort of then more of the chitta vipassana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And trying to, because for me the thoughts are sort of, they're floating on the top of like those churning.
Yeah, because I think that's important as well, in that sense of recognizing, the thought doesn't just sort of appear fully formed out of nothing, or just out of the ether. These are causal processes and understanding that. Again, because that's where, like in the, yeah, in the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha is, you know, having us investigate from that feeling of the jitta sankhara, that the mind conditioners, the thought conditioners that are feeling and perception, and having that underlying tone, having one's finger on the pulse of that, because there's going to be, all your thoughts are going to be arising from that.
I could just get some clarification on the last two, sort of mind and mental formations. Is mind like the mood of the mind, if it's unhappy or if it's going towards positive things? Whereas mental formations are like in the thoughts realm?
More complicated than that, but the mental mind is, especially from this perspective, it's more around that underlying tone of the mind or underlying content as well. Whereas the mental, the jitta sankhara, the mental formations are thought, but they're also emotion as well. Like, so that your jitta sankhara is also emotion. Joy is a jitta sankhara. Actually, mindfulness is a jitta sankhara, but it's these are the you know, sort of the formations that are being arising out of the mind.
Okay. Well, Bob, something a more clarification on the phrase of like. The body in the body and feeling the feelings. And I still don't quite understand what that means. Yeah, I wouldn't know what it means, like, for the body, if you not be aware of the body in the body. Or
well, that sense of I think seeing body in the body. I mean, that's one of the older translations, and because of the Pali language, as he explained. It's a locative case, so that it's actually establishing a location, and it's sort of in. So that Ajahn Jeff's translation of in and of itself, I think, is very helpful. So that in the sense you're paying attention to your body, you're not having to. You're using that as a foundation, and using that's your continuity. You're not having to extrapolate from that and go the body as something that is, well, you know, how is it perceived externally? Is it, you know, is it beautiful? Is it unbeautiful? Is it accepted? Is it unaccepted? How do you know? It's all, you know, it's just the body. So then you're starting to use that as a basin. Same with feeling, yeah. Rather than it turning into something else of saying a sense of self, a sense of you know what the world values it or what the sense of self identifies with it. It's just a body or a feeling, and it's this helpful tool that helps us to cut through the almost immediate overlaying of identification and value that we place on things.
I think I get it. So, for example, to be where the body is, the body, yesterday was talking about the elements, like, you know, various kinds of contemplation, the same fire, and if you're like starting to extrapolate, oh, fire means, you know, I'm feeling heat, and it means this, or
yes,
that's going outside. You just aware of heat as heat, and that's it.
Yeah, it's sort of helping you to simplify the immediate associations and proliferations that are second nature to us.
Just reminds me of the simile that Ajahn Chah uses of experiencing the taste of the mango rather than the idea of the taste of the mango.
Because that's... you know, all of the things that we can start reading into it real quick. Okay.